Today is Wednesday, March 10th, 2010. I am sitting here, Sherry Bowers, local history coordinator, sitting here with Larry Russell, curator of the Edison Birthplace. We are going to talk about the birthplace and talk about the photographs that were taken by Larry Lambert 20 years ago of various individuals around Milan. And I'd like to start by asking Larry how long he has been at the Edison Birthplace.
Well, come June, it will be 45 years.
45 years.
Mm-hmm.
So when this picture was taken 20 years ago, around 20 years ago, you were already at the birthplace 25 years.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
So because you've been at the birthplace so long, you've seen so many changes. Larry, when you first came to Milan, did you come here? Were you born here, or did you come here?
No, I was born in Cooperstown, New York.
Cooperstown, New York. So when did you move to Milan?
In 1965, in June.
June of 1965?
Mm-hmm. Came here for the job.
You came here for the job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that part of your history here. So when you first came to the birthplace, was your title originally as curator, or what was the job posting for?
Yeah, that was the posting.
And so what I'd like to maybe talk to you about, a little bit about when the photograph was taken, but can you tell me about kind of the history of your role at the birthplace? I know after 45 years you've seen many changes. What essentially were your duties when you first came, and maybe how are they a little bit different now? Because I know technology has certainly changed some things, but some things are still the same, I'm sure, with the tours and what you do at the birthplace.
Well, we were open much more at the time. We opened at 9 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday through Sunday, and stayed till 5 o'clock. And I can still remember Edison's daughter saying, we should take people up to 5 of 5. And that, of course, has changed a great deal. Now we've had to cut back hours to save money, and we don't take tours after a half hour before closing time, because it takes about 45 minutes, sometimes an hour, to go through the house. So that way you're going to run over anyway. And when I came here, well, we had a gentleman who did the grounds. I never saw him by work so fast as he did. He was told that he had to cut back, you know, even then, the hours. And he could do almost anything, I think. He was quite amazing. He lived out in Shug Road. Can't remember. What was his name? Isn't that strange? Well, that's what happens when you get old. Maley. Was it Ed Maley, I believe? Yes. Yeah, he was a little wiry, bent over individual, but he could really work. You never seen anybody today that works like he did. I mean, he had the old fashioned work ethic. So he did sort of really took care of the grounds, although I remember it came to the point that I had to mow all the lawns as well. I did just about everything. I would wax the floors in the birthplace at my hands and knees. And, you know, it was kind of a chief cook and bottle washer deal, and I had to do all the advertising and pretty much all of the paperwork. Although at that point we had a treasurer who was based in West Orange, New Jersey, which was furnished by probably the Charles Edison Fund did back then. So I would send the reports in, and then they would take care of all the big work. Before we got through, before I retired from paperwork, I had to do it all on this end once we got a treasure, you know, in Milan. There were long days, but then, of course, I was younger at that point, so I didn't really mind much. And the tours, I think when I started out, lasted about 35 minutes, and they're a lot longer than that now. We have some guides that go, you know, over an hour. So, And what was it? I think it cost 50 cents maybe when I came here to go through, and now it's up to $7. So, and every time, of course, we raised the admissions, it cut back the amount of people we had. In the early, well, in the late 60s and around 70, we had as many as, oh, maybe close to 23, 24,000 people, which was really busy. And now it's back down to maybe 7 or 8,000. So there's quite a change in the volume.
Is it because, are there less school groups coming through?
Yes, particularly these last few years, because they just to cut out field trips. I understand that the local school district doesn't have field trips, except they have the one to Greenfield Village, you know. But it's, we had schools come from a long distance at that point. They would come, you know, as far as Toledo or Cleveland, either way. And now, of course, it's closer by, you know, because of the gas problem.
That wouldn't surprise me about the school groups decreasing over the years, because I know, like you said, in our own school district, it's been hard to keep funding for field trips.
Yeah.
And that's probably really a shame, you know, because, you know, that's a highlight of so many, you know, especially for school children, their visits to these places where maybe, you know, they wouldn't be able to go with their parents or family.
The interesting thing, and I regret this, is that they have decided to bring younger children now, and they don't have the background. A second grader doesn't understand these things, and it's very difficult to hold them because, well, I've seen the attention span shrink like crazy in 45 years. You know, people, although I don't think the discipline is much different, of course, when I first came here, I can remember a gentleman who was a superintendent. Maybe it's just I don't remember the school. But at any rate, he paddled a child, took him over his knee and paddled him right out by the bus when I was first here. But they weren't better behaved back then than they are today, basically. We've had some rather interesting groups. I think one I'll never forget is we had a group come from Oberlin, Ohio. And they were probably fifth or sixth graders, I don't know. But they were the toughest kids I've ever seen in my life, and just awfully, the lack of control was terrible. They had a young teacher, and he apparently was very sarcastic and unpleasant to them. And so they transferred that to me, and I told them they weren't going to talk that way and act that way. You know, that's just And I told the teacher, I said, do not ever bring any children like this again here, because we won't put up with this kind of thing. Well, they never did come again. We've never had a group from Oberlin since. But they were really terrible. I had a little girl. Little, she was fifth or sixth grader. She had a pocketbook that she was swinging, and she said to me, "Hello there, honey." I mean, a fifth or sixth grader talking to somebody who's an adult in their 30s. So no, children aren't worse than they ever were. But I do regret the fact that fourth grade is, I think, about the right age group for our tours.
You know, it's interesting you say fourth grade, because I'm not sure of this, but I think that part of the content standards for the state of Ohio, local history is taught at about the fourth grade level. I remember...
It used to be fourth and seventh grade Ohio history when I first came here.
Yes, and I think then they moved it to fourth grade, back to fourth grade for the local history, fourth or fifth. So mm-hmm. And maybe that's part of the reasoning behind that, is that being a perfect time. Can you share with me some funny stories of whether it be adults or children, some things that were said as people have gone through the Edison birthplace?
Funny. No, I don't remember too funny things. I remember some pretty rude comments at moments. It has constantly amazed me in the 45 years I've been here that total strangers will say some of the things that they will. I mean, I never forgot, my mother said to me when I was a child, She said, if you've got to make a fool of yourself, do it home. Well, these people, well, they don't care where they are, some of them. And it's amazing some of the things that they will say. We had a lady, I'll never forget, I think it was when Sue Ingersoll, Sue Mills now, was working. And this car just came barreling up Edison Drive and stopped and across from the birthplace. And the person ran out and accosted Sue and just railed about Nikola Tesla, who was, of course, the one that was responsible for high voltage current and Niagara Falls, that type of thing. And she just stood there and looked at him. When he got through with his tirade, he got back in the car and drove off. Well, there's one I can't tell you because it's rather smutty, so I guess I won't do that one. But people just really don't care what people think of them when they're out in public. Well, I will tell you, now I've started, you can x-rate this if you want to. But I had this trio come in, a father and mother and a college student. And we were in the house in the exhibit room, which is quite close quarters. And the mother and the son had this very close rapport, and she broke wind. And they began to laugh and carry on like little second or third graders, and they were elbowing each other. You know, this is kind of strange behavior for a mother and a son. The father got over the corner somewhere. He didn't want to have anything to do with them whatsoever, but I will never forget that, and I had all I could do to keep a straight face. That was very difficult, you know, and I thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, people just don't act this way in public, but apparently they do.
You know, when you talk about people in the public, how far have, I know you have a diverse population, I believe because of, especially dealing with Japan, mm-hmm. I know that you have a connection with Japan.
Although that's slowing down.
Okay.
The Japanese don't have the money they had before to travel, but always very polite, nice people.
What about, where would you say in terms of, and I don't know if over the years the birthplace has kept kind of statistics on this, where in the world, other parts of the world, would you say that most of your visitors came from Japan or the Asia or where, how many European visitors? Is that something that you keep in terms of statistics? Or?
Yes, we do, or we used to. They haven't done it the last year or two, but we used to have 40 or 50 countries represented, and it was interesting. I think two people that stand out in my mind were from Israel.
Okay.
And they were very nice people. They made the comment, however, that since they'd been here, the thing that impressed them the most about Americans was that they were rather brassy and that they were hooked on money, so, which I thought was funny coming from people that, you know, that are Jewish and that you usually think of as, you know, into material things. And I remember the man said to me, and I thought, you know, people, there's nothing they don't talk about. And he said to me, he said, how in heaven's name can you believe that Jesus Christ was God? He said, God who defecates, who has sex. And I said, well, theoretically, Jesus didn't have any sex, you know. But, I mean, they bring up all these crazy topics that you can't believe that they would, you know, deal with. And the interesting thing to me that the Jewish people that I've talked to from Israel, they have no fear whatsoever. Wouldn't you think living in that hot spot of the world they would, but they don't seem to have any fear of what's going to happen at all. We don't have many black people, which is interesting. And when we do, there's no problem, but I have no prejudices whatsoever. At least I think I don't. Probably I do, but I have never. I brought up in a small town in Upper New York State. It was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, there weren't even Catholics in town, you know. And then it began to change, and I can remember seeing migrant children coming in the fall. They lived in just deplorable conditions in long shacks that you wouldn't put your animals in. Say nothing about people, and. I've watched through the years, you know, we're not supposed to say anything because if we do, we're racist. But it's interesting, I found that there are a lot of black people that we have taken through. Well, I better say not a lot because there aren't that many that come, but there is a majority that you can sense an attitude. And I suppose maybe if I had been come, you know, well, they were slaves, I mean, in the Civil War. But, I mean, there is still an attitude, and they really aren't awfully fond of white people. But then there, I've had, just before Obama was elected, I had this lovely, perfect family with 2.5 children, you know, the statistic. And they were in the house, and that father was spewing the most awful racism that I've ever heard in my life in front of his children. And I thought, this is really very, very sad. And of course, you never say anything. The customer's always right. But I thought that was, you know, you can see why there's hatred in the world. It just keeps being passed down, and that's unfortunate.
Have you ever learned something from the people that have gone through, or just maybe stopped to see the birthplace, something that you didn't know?
Oh my, yes, a lot of things. Although I'm not sure how many of them were actually factual. Mm-hmm. People have misconceptions. And remember, who was it that said a little learning is a dangerous thing? Was that, I don't remember, it wasn't Johnson. Well, who was it? I can't remember, it was one of the English poets, I think, that said it. It's been so long that I don't remember my English literature much anymore. I was an English major. I don't know. It's interesting. I find that we get people from all stratas of life, and if you are kind and to people and you give them the idea that you are trying to give them something for their money, most of the people respond extremely well. Every once in a while, I get people that don't. There are people, you know what I'm talking about, you start talking to them, and it's almost as if this curtain comes down and shuts out everything that they don't want to hear, they don't want to learn. It was funny, I had a man come in the house, this was years ago, and he said to me, I want you to tell me everything you can about this house and about Thomas Edison. And I stared, and he says, oh, hell, that's history, I don't want to hear that. I just looked at him in disbelief. I thought, okay, whatever you say. And so, of course, we didn't. And it was funny. Mrs. Sloan said herself, she said, I do not like guided tours. But she said, we have to have them. And then she told the funny story about how she and some friends were in Williamsburg. And they got, she said, this guide cornered us in the room. And she talked and talked and talked. And she said, I got to giggling. I couldn't help it because it was silly. Well, there are all kinds of approaches. When Ruth and I were able to go places, we would go to museums. And I'll never forget, we went to Williamsburg. And this lady, she looked like a China doll that had come to life. She was beautiful, and she had her lovely costume on. And everybody was just listening to her. She had them enchanted. Well, she said, this is probably the only building on the North American continent that was designed by Sir Christopher Wren. And I turned to Mrs. Sharp, who was my assistant at the time, and I said, do you suppose she talks to her husband that way when she's home? But that's a docent. A guide, you know, is quite different than a docent. And I've never tried to put on. I've just tried to meet people where they were and be who I was. But I thought it was funny. It worked for her. You have to find what works for you. I used to train the guides until they got so nervous having me listen to them. They couldn't stand it. But which is funny because I don't think I'm very... well, I shouldn't be really upsetting anybody, you know, and making them feel nervous. I'm pretty common, ordinary sort of an individual. But anyway, I've always said to the guides, you know how you want to do this, how you want to approach the people, and what works for you, and that's what you have to do. Just as long as you're polite to the people and nice. I think there was only one time that something really bad happened in the house, and because it was our neighbor, we didn't do anything about it. But we had a young girl working for us from Norwalk as a guide. And this was the period when people were rather scantily clad. You remember when the mini skirts came out?
Yes.
Well, the neighbor across the road had his son-in-law and daughter visiting him. They were artists. He was an artist. And the son-in-law, who was a married man, was practically, well, children in high school or later. And he waited. The rest of them went down, the family, to the Milan Historical Museum. And so he came over and took the tour. And when she came back from the tour, her face was red, she was angry, she was furious. He had stayed behind in the group and put his hands on her in the house. And I said to her, well, you should have told the people, stay with me, this man is molesting me. But she, of course, was a teenager and she was afraid. And that's the only time we've ever had anything like that happen. And we didn't call the police because we felt, well, obviously she got with the people again. But I mean, it was a bad experience for her. But because it was the neighbors, we didn't want to start an investigation or anything. But that's the only time, and I've always worried, I've always told the young girls, if you feel uncomfortable going into the house with one man alone, we don't want you to do this. You know, and we have a place where they can press a buzzer in the house so that we can go over right away. But she had never expected anything like that. The man was, oh golly, he was in his 40s. Which is, I guess, the dangerous age, they say. But, I mean, that was really bad to do that to a young girl. Soon after that, she decided to find something else to do. She went to work at IGA. But that's the only time we've ever had a bad experience like that. And my mother always used to say there's safety in numbers, but apparently there wasn't, because the people went on and he stayed behind, you know. Mm-hmm. And she was just livid and scared to death. And so that's the only really bad experience I remember through the 45 years.
Now, do you receive, Larry, you probably receive different collections or, items from time to time or have through the years.
Yeah.
Do you still receive something related to Thomas Edison or that would be appropriate for the birthplace?
Yes, from time to time, but not so often. People want to give you the diamond disc records, the thing flat records that he made. And we have some of them coming out of our ears, but we usually take what people give us if we have space to store it, and it's something to do. And we do play the records for people, so it's good to have a few extra. But rather interesting, and it's on loan. How did she get a hold of it? Well, this lady lives in Hudson, Ohio. And I don't think I don't want to say that she's not related. But anyway, she had this lovely painting that some family member had commissioned of Edison's grandfather, Captain Samuel Edison. And so she's loaned it to us, and it's in the parlor. And it's very nice. And it's rather interesting because it was done after he died, and it was done from a tintype, which we have the original of. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because in the tintype, he looks like the meanest person you've ever seen in your life. And the poor man had long arthritic fingers. I mean, he was 92 when they took that picture of him. And the interesting thing is, in the painting, he looks like a beatific saint. This lovely smile on his face, and his hands are healed. So I guess he got something good out of joining the Baptist Church. Must have been a miracle. What was funny, he joined the Baptist Church, and they threw him out for railing because he couldn't keep his mouth shut. The Edisons were very outspoken, independent people. And then they got his wife on non-attendance. He was married twice and he had 13 children, and the last four were born after he was 60 years old. So he was a character. One biographer called him that engaging old sinner, which I thought was funny. But the Edisons were definitely interesting people.
Tell me a little bit about the house. When you go through and you give the tour, do you start out by describing the architecture of the house or anything related to...
That's interesting. I never discuss it architecturally much. We give them a background outside about how they got here from Vienna, Ontario, which is near London, Ontario. It's funny, I always say, when it comes to wars, they were the biggest bunch of losers you've ever seen. They always joined the wrong side. Edison's great-grandfather John was a little boy. His mother was a widow, and she came over before the Revolution from the Zuider Zee area in Holland. And he grew up to be a Tory in the American Revolution. Well, they put the poor man in jail for over a year, and they didn't know what to do with John. And so finally, they shipped him up to Nova Scotia. And some of the family were born, of course, up there. And then they migrated to Vienna, Ontario. Then Edison's grandfather got his captain's title fighting us in the War of 1812 on the British side. Then Edison's father got mixed up with a bunch of rebels in the Papineau-Mackenzie Rebellion in the middle 1830s, and he had to flee for his life. And he crossed over 75 miles of Canada on foot, pretty much, in the winter. Mm-hmm. Oh, they were a rugged bunch. Edison's father said, "I can outfight, outrun, and out-wrestle anybody that lives in my hometown." Well, there were characters. And so the politics were always wrong. Edison's father, when they moved from here to Port here in Michigan, was a Confederate sympathizer in Michigan in the Civil War era. So, I mean, that, you know, you can see they were a little cantankerous, but they were very definitely, you know, they did their thing. They were definite-minded. And, of course, this is why Edison had the ability to stick to things, I think, because, they just didn't give up. Mm-hmm. They were rather stubborn individuals. But we give them a background of the house, and then we tell them that Edison's father built it. And we do tell them about the floors are original on two levels, but the kitchen floor has been a replacement in the basement. They got boards out of an old schoolhouse and put them down there. The kids love them because they squeak and they're getting to the point that they need to be, you know, bolstered up somehow. But basically, I don't think the room arrangement has been changed a great deal. I think the kitchen may have been altered a little bit in the basement. I think they cut off part of it and used it as a storage room. But he was a very wise builder because it's a fooler from outside. It looks like there wouldn't be any room in the house at all. And there's two bedrooms upstairs and the parlor and the sitting room on the main floor. And then across the back, I think probably there were originally three little bedrooms. Now there's two and it's been cut up into room to store cleaning supplies and whatever. When I came here, it was a bathroom. Of course, his cousin, Miss Wadsworth, lived in the house for 30 years until she died in 1944. And the bathroom, we found out, was emptying raw sewage onto the inside, which is, you know, the way people did things back then. So Edison's daughter had the bathroom taken out altogether, so there isn't any bathroom in the house. Basically, it's pretty much as it was, and then there's two bedrooms upstairs.
So it was a private residence until 1944, you said?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say 8 or 10 families probably lived in it in the 40 years that it was out of the family. They moved in 1854, and Marion, his sister, who lived up here on the Homer Page farm, Robert's great-great-great-grandmother, bought it back. And she gave it to Belle, her daughter, as a wedding present. And then Edison bought it back in 1906, and he owned it till he died. It was interesting. I would have never known this, but when I first came here, there was an elderly gentleman that came to take the tour. And when we got to the backyard, there are carvings in the foundation, stone foundation. And he said, my father, Charles Henry Wakefield, was the last person to live in the birthplace before Marion bought it back. And it's right, because this is 1893. So, but he said, my father was so proud he lived in the house where Edison was born that he carved his initials, and he'd come back to see it as an old man, which was very interesting. And it made him happy to see it. There are other initials that we just don't know, whether they were the, somebody that helped him build, or maybe it's, you know, who knows why they're there, but they are. But that was an interesting experience. You, every once in a while, you bump into somebody. And of course, a lot of people get kind of confused, and they will say, oh, my grandmother played with Edison when she lived in Milan. Well, and went to school with him. Well, he didn't go to school in Milan. He was too ill. He had respiratory problems, I think. And I think Nancy was just scared to send him to school because the three middle children had died here, you know. And so he went to school in Port Huron. But they're very sure that they did. And then, of course, there are people now. And we have people who want to go in the house, and the trustees have decided it's not a good idea, but supernatural business. That they claim that the house is haunted, and they, well, we had one woman go through on the tour, and she taped things, you know, supposedly. And it's interesting, one of the ladies who is on the staff, who guides, has seen Miss Wadsworth in the parlor, sitting on the horsehair settee that was Marion's. And I thought, well, you know, I've been there 45 years, I've never seen or experienced anything like that. I guess I'm not attuned, but there are people that have.
That is interesting. I think I've heard some things about, you know, people wanting to find out or coming back and looking for spirits that may be in the house. Speaking of coming back, I know that there are some various photographs around, and people, there are some residents in this area that remember as very young children, when Edison came back to the square with
23, yes.
Yes, with Harvey Firestone
and Henry Ford.
Uh-huh. Do you know a little bit about that, or did he visit the birthplace when he came back, or is
there a connection? Well, you see, the reason that they were in the area, Warren G. Harding died, and he had camped with them. So they went to Marion to his funeral, and Miss Wadsworth says in her reminiscences, apparently she was downtown in Milan somewhere. And in those days, of course, she didn't lock your house. And when she came back, she found Edison and Ford and Firestone in the parents' bedroom upstairs, and he was regaling his two cronies with all the things that he got into as a child, which must have taken him a while. Oh, he was a handful. I think if Sam Edison were here now at this particular point when we're being having an interview, he would say probably, and there would be no reason that he wouldn't be frank, because he was, but he would probably say, I had more trouble with that last child than I did the other six put together. Well, they clashed like crazy. I mean, they were definite-minded people. Well, anyway, they started down the stairs from the parents' bedroom, and Edison turned to Miss Wadsworth, and he said, Madam, push the button. I'm an old man. I'm afraid I'll fall. It's getting dark, you know. And she turned to him and she said, T.A., you never put any lights in the house. She was using lamps and candles. Well, you were never sure how he reacted to things. And he didn't think that was funny. And he said, you get out and get those fixtures right away. And she writes in her reminiscences, you may believe I didn't hesitate. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can still hear his daughter saying to me, Father never suffered fools gladly.
Interesting.
Oh yeah, they were very volatile people. I worked for his daughter for 10 years. She was very fair and she was very generous, but you knew exactly where you stood with her because she told you.
And that's, you referred to her?
Madeline Edison Sloan.
Okay, that's what I wanted you to give her full name so that people would know who she was.
Yeah, she opened it the day he would have been 100 in 1947. And I think, from what I know, and I don't know all that much, But I met the last three children. I didn't meet the first three. They were dead by the time I came. In fact, Marion died, his oldest child, died, I think it was 92 when she died in 1965, the year I came. She had not had a particularly nice life. She married a German army officer, and as I always tell the people, let's put it in the terminology of the day, he was a rover. And the bombs are falling. It's World War I. She's scared to death, and she fled out to Switzerland. And her father paid her way back and bought her a cottage in Connecticut. She never married again. I mean, she'd had enough potatoes out of that dish. And she lived to be elderly. I think she was about 92 when she died in 65. The boys had a terrible time, the early two boys, Thomas Jr. and William, because they were simple and uncomplicated, like Edison's first wife, Mary, was. She was... Well, she just wasn't his equal, you know. And she, well, I like to call her a Barbara Streisand person, people who need people, and he was never home, you know. And so she had a hard time, I think, harder than Mina did. Mina was a very superior individual, his second wife, Mina Miller. Her father co-founded Chautauqua, our first summer school. And they educated their kids to the hilt. Mina said, and the men aren't crazy about this statement, but obviously they didn't educate women back then like they do today. And Mina said, women should be educated more than men. They have more influence on the children. Interesting little statement. Well, anyway, the boys, the first two boys, Edison pretty much supported them most of their lives. In fact, he made his oldest son, Thomas Jr., take somebody else's last name because he was disgracing the family. The people were using his name to advertise things, you know. And so Edison, he took the name of Willard. I don't know why he chose that, but he did. The next three, of the six, I think Mrs. Sloan was probably most like her father. She was very outspoken and independent and very determined. And... Charles was governor of New Jersey and Secretary of Navy under Franklin Roosevelt. I met him just once. He came to the birthplace, and he was just a kind, nice, old, elderly gentleman who had a hearing problem. It's funny, he and Mrs. Sloan never got along. She never went to her brother's funeral or wedding. And she wrote to her mom, oh, Mina was pretty nearly a saint, Edison's second wife. She had to be. She had these kids that were definite-minded and a husband who was something else. Mina said once, and she would have never said any more than this because she loved him and she put up with him for 45 years, but she said very sweetly to an interviewer when she got older, she said, it's not always easy to be married to someone who's great. And that was probably the understatement of the age. So anyway, she got this letter from, Mina got this letter from her daughter, Mrs. Sloan, and Charles was married down in Fort Myers at their winter home. And she said, well, Mother, was there anybody down there at the ceremony besides you and the alligators? Yeah. Theodore, I, to this moment, I am amazed that I had the nerve to do this. But I was being entertained in Mrs. Sloan's home. By the way, she lived in Llewellyn Park in West Orange, right next to, you know, near where her father did. The three children by Mina all had homes in Llewellyn Park. It's billed as our first planned residential park in the country, which means, of course, nobody's ever lived there that didn't have money. And one day I said to her, would it be possible to meet Theodore? That was the baby. I think I've always felt they saved the best to last. He was very reserved when I met him. I met him and he had a beat up old overcoat sweeping out in the barn. That's the way he'd have found his father. He was a worker, but a very brilliant man. He went off to MIT and he graduated in physics and math. I would guess probably of the six kids he was the smartest. And he worked on the scientific end with his father. As Edison put it, he said, Theodore's a good boy, but he's going to fly off into the air with all that theory. He said, you know, I don't know whether he can work with me or not. Well, of course he did. Edison didn't like math and theory. He said, I can hire a mathematician. They can't hire me, which was true enough. But that was those were the six children, and they were very interesting. And they really... I think they were all fond of their father, but I don't think they saw him an awful lot. I mean, you don't get 1,093 American patents to your credit without somebody sacrificing. Mm-hmm. And he worked a lot. And Mina, I'm sure, probably wasn't any happier with it than Mary was, but she had the inner resources that Mary didn't, and she was into Garden Club and Red Cross and Audubon Society and that sort of thing, and she made life for herself. Hey, can you imagine? This lady is 20. She's marrying a 39-year-old widower and inheriting three kids, 11 and younger. Or no, 13. Well, I think Marion was about 13 when she married her. So she had her work cut out for her. Mm-hmm. There was no doubt. But they were an interesting family. Edison said, this will give you an idea of what I meant when I said he was very outspoken. This woman wrote to him, and she was extremely upset. I don't know where I got this story, but it wasn't in the main biographies, I'm sure. And she was unhappy because he wasn't making enough classical music recordings to suit her. And he wrote back to her and he said, "Madam, I appreciate your point of view." But he said, "I have to make what the general public will buy." And he said, "The general public's a bunch of Zulus." Now, if that is not outspoken, I don't know what is.
Interesting. I guess I never thought about that side of Edison. You know, and that's interesting. I imagine you share these stories with people as you guide them through sometimes.
Well, you have to be careful who you tell them to, I think. And I just really feel that it's important that people understand he was a human being, mm-hmm. and he was extremely human. But I think he was basically a good human being. But he had his moments, and everything would be going along just fine. This was the same way with his daughter. Then all at once it wasn't. You know, they were volatile, reacting people, you know, very definitely. And I suppose he probably got that from Sam. I don't know where he got it, probably from his father, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You know, I look at this picture of the birthplace and a few 20 years ago, and of course we retook the picture.
Don't ever show it to me. I probably would be horrified.
But it's still a wonderful picture, and you look, you know, there's quite a few pictures out there circulating of the birthplace, but I look at it and I think that probably is forever etched in the minds of so many people, that birthplace picture, and to hear some of the history, too, of, you know, what you've told us about the house and the Edison family.
Well, I've told you a lot of things I shouldn't have told you.
Larry, I have a question. How big would you say the collection is that you probably have at the birthplace? I know in terms of, is there a number to put in terms of what you have?
I'm sure there is, but I don't know what it is. We have everything on computer now. Mm-hmm. But I never sat and counted, mm-hmm. so I have no idea. I remember that I had to accession things, a lot of them, when I came here and stay up nights in the birthplace. That's why I think it's so silly that people think it's haunted, because I never heard or saw anything. It would be mm-hmm. a little creaking in the wind, but I had to do everything in cards, and then we still kept the cards, but we put them now on a program on the computer. It was interesting. I can remember when Richard Schaefer was our photographer.
Okay, yes, I do know. He had a studio on the square, correct?
Yes, he did. That's right. I'd forgotten that. Then he moved it out to Seminary Road, you know, back in the trees. Yes, and now, poor dear, he has Alzheimer's, I suppose, or dementia on the two. He's had such a good wife, and she takes care of him, so, and he was always so neat and so well-groomed, and he still is, she says he doesn't know anyone.
Now, you said he was the photographer for the
yes.
birthplace?
Well, he was a photographer, town photographer, and he took pictures for the birthplace, so we're making in postcards, and he swore that when he was in there, he saw a face in the window, and that he also heard rappings in the kitchen, and I always thought that was interesting. There are a lot of people that have, and I'm not immune to that sort of thing. I can remember quite a few years ago, I played at the Methodist Church, the organ, for a period of time. I think it was about 3 years, and then I played at the Presbyterian for about 12 or 13. And it was interesting, at that point, at the Presbyterian Church, there was a terrible feud going on within the church. And this was the dead of winter, and I was in there practicing, and as I stopped, I heard these low, murmuring voices. I'm not given to hearing things that aren't there. And so I went into the connection where the voices seemed to be coming from. They were rather low and sad. That's the only way I could describe them. And when I got there was nobody there. There were only my tracks into the church. That was it. Mm-hmm. There were no footsteps. And I have never been able to explain that. And the same thing happened in the basement of the Methodist church. I heard people. I heard a man's voice talking. And that it was the same thing. It was a winter again. And I've never been able. So I'm not one of those persons who poo-poos another dimension. I couldn't prove or disprove. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen anything. But I have heard things. And I know I heard them. Mm-hmm. Or I wouldn't have gone to look. I mean, it was the dead of, you know, it was in the height of daylight. So I don't know how to explain it. It was interesting. I went to the Edison Mansion in West Orange, New Jersey. And Thelda Coakley was the hostess there. She had worked for Edison, testing electric appliances. Lovely lady. And her husband had been his public relations man. And they were the best two Edison guides I think I ever heard anywhere. And she told me, we were talking about this spiritualistic business. I had read in an article that in the 1890s, it was in the Banner of Light, I think was the name of this periodical, that there were seances in the Edison birthplace and that Thomas and his brother William believed in it. Well, I kind of hesitated because Nancy was a Baptist minister sister, and I wouldn't have thought she would have had Ouija boards and that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, as I was talking to Mrs. Coakley, she said, well, that's interesting. She said, because I always thought there are spiritualistic books in the library here in the Edison Mansion. And she said, I always thought they probably belonged to the gentleman who built the house. He was a skunk. He built it with his company's money, and then he had to run away, and Edison got a good deal on the house. And she said, maybe Edison had these. And then she said to me, I'm going to tell you something I've never told anybody before. She said, one day, she said, I was in my house and I was doing dishes, and she said, the hair went right up in the back of my neck. And she said, I knew there was a presence in the room with me. And she said, I whirled around and this tall, dark man was standing. And she said, I couldn't have mistaken it because he was silhouetted right against the window. And she said, he never said anything. And he never spoke. But she said, I knew instinctively that we were not welcome there. And she said, you know, years later we moved and I never had another experience like that. But she said, we found that our house had been built on an Indian burying ground. So people do have experiences, you know, apparently like that. And she was one of those sophisticated people that you would have never, never expected to say something like mm-hmm. that. So, but I have never seen Miss Wadsworth. I think I would like to. Mm-hmm. Marietta was a very lovely lady, I think. And I think it would have been nice to see her, but I don't ever expect to. I'm not a visual person anyway. I hear things. Mm-hmm. That's why, I mean, I'm a musician and I hear things, but I don't see things. It was interesting. My next door neighbor, Mr. Cooley, who lived next to the birthplace for years, used to say to me, well, he said, you know, people, he said, have... How did he put it? He didn't use the word delusion, but it was pretty close to it. He said people think they see and hear things and they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just projected out of their mind. So I don't know. I have no answers for those sort of things. But there are a lot of people who have had experience. I had a young man who was in my group, and we were coming down. It was summer, so he had short sleeves on, and the hair was standing up on his arms. And he said to me, what is going on in here? And I said, what do you mean? And he wouldn't talk anymore. He wouldn't say another word. Strange. So some people have had experiences. So who knows?
It's interesting. Well, there's certainly a lot of literature you know, out there about those kinds of experiences. And you're right, you know, it's an ongoing debate of sorts.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to take a side either way, but all I know is that I have had times that I know that I have been protected and watched over. I couldn't, you know, I just know I have. And I can't explain them. So I think there are a lot of things that one can't explain. I think it's just as well. I think we've taken all the mystery and the joy out of life because we've made everything so technological and so very materialistic. And you realize, as well as I do, that religion is dying out bit by bit in many areas. And people don't believe in a creator. And I think this is very unfortunate because I think people are ruling out a part of their of life that's very, very essential. But, you know, I never argue with people. They can do as they want.
You said something interesting about technology. And I look at the birthplace or the role of, maybe we should conclude with something like this, but the role of the birthplace, and even though you can see, you know, people can look online on virtual tours, I still think, and I want you to tell me if you agree with this, that there's still something so unique about physically going to a place like this and actually being able to be part of the whole, you know, situation, or when you're going through and being guided on a tour and actually physically being there in that location and looking at a house or a site. Do you think that's true? That
I think it's definitely true. I'm not putting down virtual tours because I think it's amazing what we can do. Mm-hmm. The computer age is, yeah, you know, something we would have never dreamed of. But on the other hand, it's not the same as being there. Mm-hmm. And I have very fond memories of places that I have visited. And you don't get the ambience, the feeling that you actually get when you're there. I think the best experience I've ever had historically in my whole life was at Monticello. It was funny, we took a whole carload of people, well, station wagon load, the staff, and we went on these long jaunts. We went to Edison places and we went to Washington, D.C. area, and it was a wonderful experience. I will always remember it. But we went to Monticello, it was rainy, it was foggy. One of the young girls with us fell and ripped up her stocking and broke her umbrella, and it was really a crummy day. And the lady there just made Jefferson come alive and the house alive because she loved him so, and you could tell that she did. Mm-hmm. And you can't, you know, you can't substitute that, the personal thing. We went to Hyde Park, and I heard Eleanor Roosevelt's recorded tour of Hyde Park. They made one of Mrs. Sloan doing the Edison Mansion in New Jersey. Hers was twice as good as Eleanor Roosevelt's. Can you believe that? Hey, how would you have liked to give a tour through a house where you had a husband who was cheating on you and a mother-in-law who was harridan? You know, you couldn't expect Eleanor to... You know, I never had realized as a child what a wonderful human being she was. Mm-hmm. But it was a pretty cool, laid-back tour. It wasn't... Now, Mrs. Sloan made the house come alive when she talked about her father, and she felt secure enough about him how she told how when they played Parcheesi, he cheated when he wasn't winning, you know, that kind of thing. And she made him really come alive, you know.
Well, that's interesting. That's, I think, a great answer or to this conclusion of the interview with Larry. I really appreciate it. And
well, I don't think it amounted to much, but you're welcome to it.
But I think it's interesting. So
you may have to edit it. You may have to even clean it up.
Well, it's very interesting, and I certainly am glad that you're here to do the tours. And
well, I enjoy it.
You've given the community the longevity, as you know, in your role at the birthplace. So I want to thank you for the interview. And
you are very welcome.
We'll conclude.